jeans that came out of left field. In the hospital cafeteria, eating rubberized French fries and red jello, I'd glance around from table to table, thinking my bona fide parents might be just a tray away. They'd sob with sheer joy to find me and whisk me off to our castle in Monaco or Romania and give me a maid that smelled like fresh sheets and my own Bernese mountain dog and a private phone line. The thing is, the first person I'd have to call to crow over my new fortune would be Kate. Kate's dialysis sessions run 3 times a week for 2 hours at a time. She has a Mahukar catheter, which looks just like her central line used to look and protrudes from the same spot on her chest. This gets hooked up to a machine that does the work her kidneys aren't doing. Kate's blood, well, it's my blood if you want to get technical about it, leaves her body through one needle, gets cleaned, and then goes into her body again through a second needle. She says it doesn't hurt. Mostly it's just boring. Kate usually brings a book or her CD player and headphones. Sometimes we play games. "Go out into the hall and tell me about the first gorgeous guy you find," Kate'll instruct. Or, "Sneak up on the janitor who surfs the net and see whose naked pictures he's downloading." When she is tied to the bed, I am her eyes and her ears. Today she is reading Allure magazine. I wonder if she even knows that every V-necked model she comes across, she touches at the breastbone, in the same place where she has a catheter, and they don't. "Well," my mother announces out of the blue, "this is interesting." She waves a pamphlet she's taken from the bulletin board outside Kate's room. "You and your new kidney. Did you know that they don't take out the old kidney? They just transplant the new one into you and hook it up." "That creeps me out," Kate says. "Imagine the coroner who cuts you open and sees you've got 3 instead of 2. "I think the point of a transplant is so that the coroner won't be cutting you open anytime soon," my mother replies. This fictional kidney she's discussing resides right now in my own body. I've read that pamphlet, too. Kidney donation is considered relatively safe surgery, but if you ask me, the writer must have been comparing it to something like a heart-lung transplant or some brain tumor removal. In my opinion, safe surgery is the kind where you go into the doctor's office and you're awake the whole time and the procedure is finished in 5 minutes, like when you have a wart removed or a cavity drilled. On the other hand, when you donate a kidney, you spend the night before the operation fasting and taking laxatives. You're given anesthesia, the risks of which can include stroke, heart attack, and lung problems. The 4-hour surgery isn't a walk in the park, either. You have a 1 in 3,000 chance of dying on the operating table. If you don't, you are hospitalized for 4 to 7 days, although it takes 4 to 6 weeks to fully recover. And that doesn't even include the long-term effects. An increased chance of high blood pressure, a risk of complications with pregnancy, a recommendation to refrain from activities where your lone remaining kidney may be damaged. Then again, when you get a wart removed or a cavity drilled, the only person who benefits in the long run is yourself. There is a knock on the door, and a familiar face peeks in. Vern Stackhouse is a sheriff, and therefore a member of the same public servant community as my father. He used to come over to our house every now and then to say hi or to leave off Christmas presents for us. More recently, he's saved Jesse's butt by bringing him home from a scrape, rather than letting the justice system deal with him. When you're part of the family with the dying daughter, people cut you slack. Vern's face is like a souffle, caving in at the most unexpected places. He doesn't seem to know whether it's all right for him to enter the room. He says. "Hi, Sarah." "Vern!" My mother gets to her feet. "What are you doing at the hospital? Everything all right?"
"Oh, yeah, fine. I'm just here on business. Serving papers, I suppose."
Vern shuffles his feet and stuffs his hand inside his jacket, like Napoleon.
I'm real sorry about this, Sarah, he says,
and then he holds out a document. Just like Kate, all the blood leaves my body. I couldn't move if I wanted to.
What the... Vern, am I being sued?
My mother's voice is far too quiet.
Look, I don't read them, I just serve them. And your name, it was right there on my list. If, there's anything I...
He doesn't even finish his sentence. With his hat in his hands, he ducks back out the door.
Mom, Kate asks, what's going on?
I have no idea.
She unfolds the papers. I'm close enough to read them over her shoulder. The State of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, it says right across the top, official as can be. Family Court for Providence County, in regard, Anna Fitzgerald, a.k.a. Jane Doe. Petition for medical emancipation.
Oh, shit, I think. My cheeks are on fire. My heart starts to pound. I feel like I did the time the principal sent home a disciplinary notice because I drew a sketch of Mrs. Toohey and her colossal butt in the margin of my math textbook. No, actually, scratch that. It's a million times worse.
That she gets to make all future medical decisions. That she not be forced to submit to medical treatment which is not in her best interests or for her benefit. That she not be required to undergo any more treatment for the benefit of her sister, Kate. My mother lifts her face to mine.
Anna, she whispers, what the hell is this?
It feels like a fist in my gut, now that it's here and happening. I shake my head. What can I possibly tell her?
Anna!
She takes a step toward me. Behind her, Kate cries out.
Mom! Oh, Mom! Something hurts. Get the nurse!
My mother turns halfway. Kate is curled onto her side, her hair spilling over her face. I think that through the fall of it, she is looking at me, but I cannot be sure.
Mommy, she moans, please.
For a moment, my mother is caught between us, a soap bubble. She looks from Kate to me and back again. My sister's in pain and I'm relieved. What does that say about me? The last thing I see as I run out of the room is my mother pushing the nurse's call button over and over, as if it's the trigger to a bomb. I can't hide in the cafeteria, or the lobby, or anywhere else that they will expect me to go, so I take the stairs to the sixth floor, the maternity ward. In the lounge there is only one phone, and it is being used.
6 pounds 11 ounces, the man says, smiling so hard I think his face might splinter. She's perfect.
Did my parents do this when I came along? Did my father send out smoke signals? Did he count my fingers and toes? Sure, he'd come up with the finest number in the universe. Did my mother kiss the top of my head and refuse to let the nurse take me away to be cleaned up? Or did they simply hand me away, since the real prize had been clamped between my belly and the placenta? The new father finally hangs up the phone, laughing at absolutely nothing. Congratulations, I say, when what I really want to tell him is to pick up that baby of his and hold her tight, to set the moon on the edge of her crib and to hang her name up in stars so that she never, ever does to him what I have done to my parents. I call Jesse collect. 20 minutes later, he pulls up in front of the entrance. By now, Deputy Stackhouse has been notified that I've gone missing. He's waiting at the door when I exit.
Anna, your mom's awfully worried about you, She's paged your dad. He's got the whole hospital being turned inside out.
I take a deep breath. Then you'd better go tell her I'm okay, I say, and I jump into the passenger door that Jesse's opened for me. He peels away from the curb and lights a Marriott, although I know for a fact he told my mother he stopped smoking. He cranks up his music, hitting the flat of his hand on the edge of the steering wheel. It isn't until he pulls off the highway at the exit for Upper Darby that he shuts the radio off and slows down.
So, did she blow a gasket?
She paged Dad away from work. In our family, it is a cardinal sin to page my father away. Since his job is emergencies, what crisis could we possibly have that compares?
Last time she paged Dad, Jesse informed me, Kate was getting diagnosed.
Great, I cross my arms. That makes me feel infinitely better. Jesse just smiles. He blows a smoke ring.
Sis, he says, welcome to the dark side.
They come in like a hurricane. Kate barely manages to look at me before my father sends her upstairs to our room. My mother whacks her purse down, then her car keys, and then advances on me.
All right, she says, her voice so tight it might snap. What's going on?
I clear my throat.
I got a lawyer.
Evidently.
My mother grabs the portable phone and hands it to me.
Now, get rid of him.
It takes enormous effort, but I manage to shake my head and drop the phone onto the cushions of the couch.
Anna, so help me,
Sarah.
My father's voice is an axe. It comes between us and sends us both spinning.
I think we need to give Anna a chance to explain. We agreed to give her a chance to explain, right?
I duck my head. I don't want to do it anymore.
That ignites my mother. Well, you know, Anna, neither do I. In fact, neither does Kate. But it's not something we have a choice about.
The thing is, I do have a choice, which is exactly why I have to be the one to do this. My mother stands over me.
You went to a lawyer and made him think this is all about you, and it's not. It's about us, all of us.
My father's hands curl around her shoulders and squeeze. As he crouches in front of me, I smell smoke. He's come from someone else's fire right into the middle of this one, and for this and nothing else, I'm embarrassed.
Anna, honey, we know you think you were doing something that you needed to do.
I don't think that,
my mother interrupts. My father closes his eyes.
Sarah, damn it, shut up!
Then he looks at me again.
Can we just talk? Just us three, without a lawyer having to do it for us?
What he says makes my eyes fill up, but I knew this was coming. So I lift my chin and let the tears go at the same time. Daddy, I can't.
For God's sake, Anna, my mother says, do you even realize what the consequences would be?
My throat closes like the shutter of a camera, so that any air or excuses must move through a tunnel as thin as a pin. I'm invisible, I think, and realize too late I have spoken out loud. My mother moves so fast I do not even see it coming, but she slaps my face hard enough to make my head snap backward. She leaves a print that stains me long after it's faded. Just so you know, shame is five-fingered. Once, when Kate was 8 and I was 5, we had a fight and decided we no longer wanted to share a room. Given the size of our house, though, and the fact that Jesse lived in the other spare bedroom, we didn't have anywhere else to go. So Kate, being older and wiser, decided to split our space in half.
Which side do you want? She asked, diplomatically. I'll even let you pick. Well, I wanted the part with my bed in it. Besides, if you divided the room in two, the half with my bed would also, by default, have the box that held all our Barbie dolls, and the shelves where we kept our arts and crafts supplies. Kate went to reach for a marker there, but I stopped her. That's on my side, I pointed out. Then give me one, she demanded, so I handed her the red. She climbed up onto the desk, reaching as high as she could toward the ceiling. Once we do this, she said, you stay on your side and I stay on my side, right? I nodded, just as committed to keeping up this bargain as she was. After all, I had all the good toys. Kate would be begging me for a visit before I'd be begging her. Swear it, she asked, and we made a pinky promise. She drew a jagged line from the ceiling, over the desk, across the tan carpet, and back up over the nightstand up the opposite wall. Then she handed me the marker. Don't forget, she said. Only cheats go back on a promise. I sat on the floor on my side of the room, removing every single Barbie we owned, dressing and undressing them, making a big fuss out of the fact that I had them and Kate didn't. She perched on her bed with her knees drawn up, watching me. She didn't react at all. Until, that is, my mother called us down for lunch. Then Kate smiled at me and walked out the bedroom door, which was on her side. I went up to the line she had drawn on the carpet, kicking at it with my toes. I didn't want to be a cheat, but I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in my room, either. I don't know how long it took my mother to wonder why I wasn't coming to the kitchen for lunch, but when you are five, even a second can last forever. She stood in the doorway, staring at the line of marker on the walls and carpet, and closed her eyes for patience. She walked into our room and picked me up, which was when I started fighting her. Don't! I cried. I won't ever get back in! A minute later, she left and returned with potholders, dish towels, and throw pillows. She placed these at odd distances all along Kate's side of the room. Come on, she urged, but I did not move. So she came and sat down beside me on my bed. It may be Kate's pond, she said, but these are my lily pads. Standing, she jumped onto a dish towel, and from there, onto a pillow. She glanced over her shoulder until I climbed onto the dish towel. From the dish towel, to the pillow, to a potholder Jessie had made in first grade, all the way across Kate's side of the room. Following my mother's footsteps was the surest way out. I am taking a shower when Kate jimmies the lock and comes into the bathroom. I want to talk to you, she says. I poke my head out from the side of the plastic curtain. When I'm finished, I say, trying to buy time for the conversation I don't really want to have. No, now. She sits down on the lid of the toilet and sighs. Anna, what you're doing, it's already done, I say. You can undo it, you know, if you want. I am grateful for all the steam between us, because I couldn't bear the thought of her being able to see my face right now. I know, I whisper. For a long time, Kate is silent. Her mind is running in circles, like a gerbil on a wheel, the same way mine is. Chase every rung of possibility, and you still get absolutely nowhere. After a while, I peek my head out again. Kate wipes her eyes and looks up at me. You do realize, she says, that you're the only friend I've got. That's not true, I immediately reply, but we both know I'm lying. Kate has spent too much time out of organized school to find a group she fits into. Most of the friends she has made during her long stretch of remission have disappeared. A mutual thing. It turned out to be too hard for an average kid to know how to act around someone on the verge of dying. And it was equally as difficult for Kate to get honestly excited about things like homecoming and SATs when there was no guarantee she'd be around to experience them. She's got a few acquaintances, sure, but mostly when they come over, they look like they're serving out a sentence and sit on the edge of Kate's bed counting down the minutes until they can leave and thank God this didn't happen to them. A real friend isn't capable of feeling sorry for you. "I'm not your friend," I say, yanking the curtain back into place. "I'm your sister." "And doing a damn lousy job at that," I think. I push my face into the shower spray, so that she cannot tell I'm crying too. Suddenly, the curtain whips aside, leaving me totally bare. "That's what I wanted to talk about," Kate says. "If you don't want to be my sister anymore, that's one thing. But I don't think I could stand to lose you as a friend." She pulls the curtain back into place, and the steam rises around me. A moment later, I hear the door open and close, and the knife slice of cold air that comes in on its heels. I can't stand the thought of losing her either. That night, once Kate falls asleep, I crawl out of my bed and stand beside hers. When I hold my palm up under her nose to see if she's breathing, a mouthful of air presses against my hand. I could press down now, over that nose and mouth, hold her when she fights. How would that really be any different than what I'm already doing? The sound of my footsteps in the hallway has me diving underneath the cave of my covers. I turn onto my side, away from the door, just in case my eyelids are still flickering by the time my parents enter the room. "I can't believe this," my mother whispers. "I just can't believe she's done this." My father is so quiet that I wonder if maybe I have been mistaken, if maybe he isn't there at all. "This is Jessie all over again," my mother adds. "She's doing it for the attention." I can feel her looking down at me, like I'm some kind of creature she's never seen before. "Maybe we need to take her somewhere alone, go to a movie or shopping, so she doesn't feel left out. Make her see that she doesn't have to do something crazy to get us to notice her. What do you think?" My father takes his time answering. "Well," he says quietly, "maybe this isn't crazy." You know how silence can push in at your eardrums in the dark? Make you deaf? That's what happens, so that I almost miss my mother's answer. "For God's sake, Brian, whose side are you on?" And my father, who said there were sides. But even I could answer that for him. There are always sides. There is always a winner and a loser. For every person who gets, there's someone who must give. A few seconds later, the door closes, and the hall light that has been dancing on the ceiling disappears. Blinking, I roll onto my back and find my mother still standing beside my bed. "I thought you were gone," I whisper. She sits down at the foot of my bed, and I inch away. But she puts her hand on my calf before I can move too far. "What else do you think, Anna?" My stomach squeezes tight. I think you must hate me." Even in the dark, I can see the shine of her eyes. "Oh, Anna," my mother sighs. "How can you not know how much I love you?" She holds out her arms and I crawl into them, as if I'm small again and I fit there. I press my face hard into her shoulder. What I want, more than anything, is to turn back time a little, to become the kid I used to be, who believed whatever my mother said was 100% true and right, without looking hard enough to see the hairline cracks. My mother holds me tighter.
We'll talk to the judge and explain it. We can fix this, she says. We can fix everything. And because those words are really all I've ever wanted to hear, I nod.
Sarah, 1990. There is an unexpected comfort to being at the oncology wing of the hospital, a sense that I am a member of the club. From the kind-hearted parking attendant who asks us if it's our first time, to the legions of children with pink emesis basins tucked beneath their arms like teddy bears, these people have all been here before us, and there's safety in numbers. We take the elevator to the third floor, to the office of Dr. Harrison Chance. His name alone has put me off. Why not Dr. Victor? He's late, I say to Brian, as I check my watch for the 20th time. A spider plant languishes, brown, on a windowsill. I hope he is better with people. To amuse Kate, who is starting to lose it, I inflate a rubber glove and knot it into a coxcomb balloon. On the glove dispenser near the sink is a prominent sign warning parents not to do this very thing. We bat it back and forth, playing volleyball, until Dr. Chance himself comes in, without a single apology for his delay. Mr. and Mrs. Fitzgerald. He is tall and rail-thin, with snapping blue eyes magnified by thick glasses and a tightly set mouth. He catches Kate's makeshift balloon in one hand and frowns at it. Well, I can see there's already a problem. Brian and I exchange a glance. Is this cold-hearted man the one who will lead us through this war? Our general? Our white knight? Before we can even backpedal with explanations, Dr. Chance takes a Sharpie marker and draws a face on the latex, complete with a set of wire-rimmed glasses to match his own. There, he says, and with a smile that changes him, he hands it back to Kate. I only see my sister Suzanne once or twice a year. She lives less than an hour and several thousand philosophical convictions away. As far as I can tell, Suzanne gets paid a lot of money to boss people around, which means, theoretically, that she did her career training with me. Our father died while mowing the lawn on his 49th birthday. Our mother never quite sewed herself together in the aftermath. Suzanne, 10 years my senior, took up the slack. She made sure I did my homework and filled out law school applications and dreamed big. She was smart and beautiful and always knew what to say at any given moment. She could take any catastrophe and find the logical antidote to cure it, which is what made her such a success at her job. She was just as comfortable in a boardroom as she was jogging along the Charles. She made it all look easy. Who wouldn't want a role model like that? My first strike was marrying a guy without a college degree. My second and third were getting pregnant. I suppose that when I didn't go on to become the next Gloria Allred, she was justified in counting me a failure. And I suppose that, until now, I was justified in thinking that I wasn't one. Don't get me wrong. She loves her niece and nephew. She sends them carvings from Africa, shells from Bali, chocolates from Switzerland. Jesse wants a glass office like hers when he grows up. We can't all be Aunt Zan, I tell him, when what I mean is that I can't be her. I don't remember which of us stopped returning phone calls first, but it was easier that way. There's nothing worse than silence, strung like heavy beads on too delicate a conversation. So it takes me a full week before I pick up the phone. I dial direct. Suzanne Crofton's line, a man says. Yes, I hesitate. Is she available? She's in a meeting. Please, I take a deep breath. Please tell her it's her sister calling. A moment later, that smooth, cool voice falls into my ear. Sarah, it's been a while. She is the person I ran to when I got my period, the one who helped me knit back together my first broken heart, the hand I would reach for in the middle of the night when I could no longer remember which side our father parted his hair on, or what it sounded like when our mother laughed. No matter what she is now, before all that, she was my built-in best friend. Zan, I say, how are you? 36 hours after Kate is officially diagnosed with APL, Brian and I are given an opportunity to ask questions. Kate messes with glitter glue with a child life specialist while we meet with a team of doctors, nurses, and psychiatrists. The nurses, I have already learned, are the ones who give us the answers we're desperate for. Unlike the doctors, who fidget like they need to be somewhere else, the nurses patiently answer us as if we are the first set of parents to ever have this kind of meeting with them, instead of the thousandth. The thing about leukemia, one nurse explains, is that we haven't even inserted a needle for the first treatment when we're already thinking three treatments down the line. This particular illness carries a pretty poor prognosis, so we need to be thinking ahead to what happens next. What makes APL a little trickier is that it's a chemo-resistant disease. What's that? Brian asks. Normally, with myelogenous leukemias, as long as the organs hold up, you can potentially reinduce the patient into remission every time there's a relapse. You're exhausting their body, but you know it will respond to treatment over and over. However, with APL, once you've offered a given therapy, you usually can't rely upon it again. And to date, there's only so much we can do. Are you saying, Brian swallows, are you saying she's going to die? I'm saying there are no guarantees. So what do you do? A different nurse answers. Kate will start a week of chemotherapy in the hopes that we can kill off the diseased cells and put her into remission. She'll most likely have nausea and vomiting, which we'll try to keep to a minimum with antiemetics. She'll lose her hair. At this, a tiny cry escapes from me. This is such a small thing, and yet it's the banner that will let others know what's wrong with Kate. Only 6 months ago, she had her first haircut. The gold ringlets curled like coins on the floor of the supercuts. She may develop diarrhea. There's a very good chance that, with her own immune system laid low, she will get an infection that will require hospitalization. Chemo may cause developmental delays as well. She'll have a course of consolidation chemotherapy about 2 weeks after that, and then a few courses of maintenance therapy. The exact number will depend on the results we get from periodic bone marrow aspirations. Then what? Brian asks. Then we watch her, Dr. Chance replies. With APL, you'll want to be vigilant for signs of relapse. She'll have to come into the ER if she has any hemorrhaging, fever, cough, or infection. And as far as further treatment, she'll have some options. The idea is to get Kate's body producing healthy bone marrow. In the unlikely event that we achieve molecular remission with chemo, we can retrieve Kate's own cells and reinstill them. An autologous harvest. If she relapses, we may try to transplant someone else's marrow into Kate to produce blood cells. Does Kate have any siblings? A brother, I say. A thought dawns. A horrible one. Could he have this too? It's very unlikely, but he may wind up being a match for an allogeneic transplant. If not, we'll put Kate on the National Registry for MUD, a matched, unrelated donor. However, getting a transplant from a stranger who's a match is much more dangerous than getting one from a relative. The risk of mortality greatly increases. The information is endless, a series of darts thrown so fast I cannot feel them sting anymore. We are told, do not think, just give your child up to us, because otherwise she's going to die. For every answer they give us, we have another question. Will her hair grow back? Will she ever go to school? Can she play with friends? Did this happen because of where we live? Did this happen because of who we are? What will it be like, I hear myself ask, if she dies? Dr. Chance looks at me. It depends on what she succumbs to, he explains. If it's infection, she'll be in respiratory distress and on a ventilator. If it's hemorrhage, she'll bleed out after losing consciousness. If it's organ failure, the characteristics will vary depending on the system in distress. Often there's a combination of all of these. Will she know what's happening? I ask, when what I really mean is, how will I survive this? Mrs. Fitzgerald, he says, as if he has heard my unspoken question. Of the 20 children here today, 10 will be dead in a few years. I don't know which group Kate will be in. To save Kate's life, part of her has to die. That's the purpose of chemotherapy, to wipe out all the leukemic cells. To this end, a central line has been placed beneath Kate's collarbone, a three-pronged port that will be the entry point for multiple medication administrations, IV fluids, and blood draws. I look at the tubes sprouting from her thin chest and think of science fiction movies. She has already had a baseline EKG to make sure her heart can withstand chemo. She's had dexamethasone ophthalmic drops because one of the drugs causes conjunctivitis. She's had blood drawn from her central line to test for renal and liver function. The nurse hangs the infusion bags on the IV pole and smooths Kate's hair. Will she feel it? I ask. Nope. Hey, Kate, look here. She points to the bag of donarubicin, covered with a dark bag to protect it from light. Spotting it are brightly colored stickers she's helped Kate make while we were waiting. I saw one teenager with a post-it note on his. Jesus saves, chemo scores. This is what starts coursing through her veins. The donarubicin, 50 milligrams in 25 cc's of D5W. Cytarabine, 46 milligrams in a D5W infusion. A continuous 24-hour IV. Allopurinol, 92 milligram IV. Or, in other words, poison. I imagine a great battle going on inside her. I picture shining armies, casualties that evaporate through her pores. They tell us Kate will most likely get sick within a few days, but it only takes 2 hours before she starts throwing up. Brian pushes the call button, and a nurse comes into the room. We'll get her some Reglan, she says, and she disappears. When Kate isn't vomiting, she's crying. I sit on the edge of the bed, holding her half on my lap. The nurses do not have time to nurse. Short-staffed, they administer antiemetics in the IV. They stay for a few moments to see how Kate responds, but inevitably, they are called elsewhere to another emergency, and the rest falls to us. Brian, who has to leave the room if one of our children gets a stomach virus, is a model of efficiency, wiping her forehead, holding her thin shoulders, dabbing tissues around her mouth. You can get through this, he murmurs to her each time she spits up, but he may only be talking to himself. And I, too, am surprising myself. With grim resolve, I make a ballet out of rinsing the emesis basin and bringing it back. If you focus on sandbagging the beachhead, you can ignore the tsunami that's approaching. Try it any other way, and you'll go crazy. Brian brings Jesse to the hospital for his blood test, a simple finger stick. He needs to be restrained by Brian and two male residents. He screams down the hospital. I stand back and cross my arms, and inadvertently think of Kate, who stopped crying over procedures 2 days ago. Some doctor will look at this sample of blood and will be able to analyze 6 proteins, floating invisibly. If these 6 proteins are the same as Kate's, then Jesse will be an HLA match, a potential donor for bone marrow for his sister. How bad can the odds be, I think, to match 6 times over? As bad as getting leukemia in the first place. The phlebotomist goes off with her blood sample, and Brian and the doctors release Jesse. He bolts off the table into my arms. Mommy, they stuck me! He holds up his finger, festooned with a Rugrats Band-Aid. His damp, bright face is hot against my skin. I hold him close. I say all the right things. But it is so, so hard to make myself feel sorry for him. Unfortunately, Dr. Chance says, your son isn't a match. My eyes focus on the houseplant, which still sits withered and brown on the sill. Someone ought to get rid of that thing. Someone ought to replace it with orchids, with birds of paradise and other unlikely blooms. It's possible that an unrelated donor will crop up on the National Marrow Registry. Brian leans forward, stiff and tense. But you said a transplant from an unrelated donor was dangerous. Yes, I did, Dr. Chan says. But sometimes it's all we've got. I glance up. What if you can't find a match in the registry? Well, the oncologist rubs his forehead. Then we try to keep her going until research catches up to her. He is talking about my little girl as if she were some kind of machine, a car with a faulty carburetor, a plane whose landing gear is stuck. Rather than face this, I turn away just in time to see one of the misbegotten leaves on the plant make its suicide plunge to the carpet. Without an explanation, I get to my feet and pick up the planter. I walk out of Dr. Chance's office, past the receptionist and the other shell-shocked parents waiting with their sick children. At the first trash receptacle I find, I dump the plant and all its desiccated soil. I stare at the terracotta pot in my hand, and I am just thinking about smashing it down on the tile floor when I hear a voice behind me. Sarah, Dr. Chance says, you all right? I turn around slowly, tears springing to my eyes. I'm fine. I'm healthy. I'm going to live a long, long life. Handing him the planter, I apologize. He nods and offers me a handkerchief from his own pocket. I thought it might be Jesse who could save her. I wanted it to be Jesse. We all did, Dr. Chance answers. Listen, 20 years ago, the survival rate was even smaller. And I've known lots of families where one sibling isn't a match, but another sibling turns out to be just right. We only have those two, I start to say, and then I realize that Dr. Chance is talking about a family I haven't had yet, of children I never intended. I turn to him, a question on my lips. Brian will wonder where we've gone. He starts to walk toward his office, holding up the pot. What plants, he asks conversationally, would I be least likely to kill? It is so easy to presume that while your own world has ground to an absolute halt, so has everyone else's. But the trash collector has taken our garbage and left the cans in the road, just like always. There is a bill from the oil truck tucked into the front door. Neatly stacked on the counter is a week's worth of mail. Amazingly, life has gone on. Kate is released from the hospital a full week after her admission for induction chemotherapy. The central line, still snaking from her chest, bells out her blouse. The nurses give me a pep talk for encouragement and a long list of instructions to follow, when to and when not to call the emergency room, when we are expected back for more chemotherapy, how to be careful during Kate's period of immunosuppression. At 6 the next morning, the door to our bedroom opens. Kate tiptoes toward the bed, although Brian and I have come awake in an instant. What is it, honey? Brian asks. She doesn't speak, just lifts her hands to her head and threads her fingers through her hair. It comes out in a thick clump, drifts down to the carpet like a small blizzard. All done, Kate announces a few nights later at dinner. Her plate is still full. She hasn't touched her beans or her meatloaf. She dances off to the living room to play. Me too, Jesse pushes back from the table. Can I be excused? Brian spears another mouthful with his fork. Not until you finish everything green. I hate beans. They're not too crazy about you either. Jesse looks at Kate's plate. She gets to be finished. That's not fair. Brian sets his fork down on the side of his plate. Fair, he answers, his voice too quiet. You want to be fair? All right, Jess. The next time Kate has a bone marrow aspiration, we'll let you get one, too. When we flush her central line, we'll make sure you go through something equally as painful. And next time she gets chemo, we'll... Brian, I interrupt. He stops as abruptly as he started, and passes a shaking hand over his eyes. Then his gaze lands on Jesse, who has taken refuge under my arm. I'm sorry, Jess, I don't... But whatever he is about to say vanishes as Brian walks out of the kitchen. For a long moment, we sit in silence. Then Jesse turns to me. Is Daddy sick, too? I think hard before I answer. We're all going to be fine, I reply. On the one-week anniversary of our return home, we are awakened in the middle of the night by a crash. Brian and I race each other to Kate's room. She lies in bed, shaking so hard that she's knocked a lamp off her nightstand. She's burning up, I tell Brian, when I lay my hand against her forehead. I have wondered how I will decide whether or not to call the doctor, should Kate develop any strange symptoms. I look at her now, and cannot believe I would ever be so stupid to believe I wouldn't know, immediately, what sick looks like. We're going to the ER, I announce, although Brian is already wrapping Kate's blankets around her and lifting her out of her crib. We bustle her to the car and start the engine, and then remember that we cannot leave Jesse home alone. You go with her, Brian answers, reading my mind. I'll stay here. But he doesn't take his eyes off Kate. Minutes later, we are speeding toward the hospital, Jesse in the back seat next to his sister, asking why we need to get up when the sun hasn't. In the ER, Jesse sleeps on a nest of our coats. Brian and I watch the doctors hover over Kate's feverish body, bees over a field of flowers, drawing what they can from her. She is pan-cultured and given a spinal tap to try to isolate the cause of the infection and rule out meningitis. A radiologist brings in a portable X-ray machine to take a film of her chest to see if this infection lives in her lungs. Afterward, he places the chest film on the light panel outside the door. Kate's ribs seem as thin as matchsticks, and there is a large gray blot just off center. My knees go weak, and I find myself grabbing onto Brian's arm. It's a tumor. The cancer's metastasized. The doctor puts his hand on my shoulder. Mrs. Fitzgerald, he says, that's Kate's heart. Pancytopenia is a fancy word that means there is nothing in Kate's body protecting her against infection. It means, Dr. Chance says, that the chemo worked, that a great majority of white blood cells in Kate's body have been wiped out. It also means that nadir sepsis, a post-chemo infection, is not a likelihood, but a given. She is dosed with Tylenol to reduce her fever. She has blood, urine, and respiratory secretion cultures taken so that the appropriate antibiotics can be administered. It takes 6 hours before she is free of the rigors, a round of violent shaking so hard that she is in danger of shimmying off the bed. The nurse, a woman who braided Kate's hair in silky cornrows one afternoon a few weeks back to make her smile, takes Kate's temperature and then turns to me. Sarah, she says gently, you can breathe now. Kate's face looks as tiny and white as those distant moons that Brian likes to spot in his telescope, still, remote, cold. She looks like a corpse. And even worse, this is a relief compared to watching her suffer. Hey. Brian touches the crown of my head. He juggles Jesse in his other arm. It is nearly noon, and we are still in pajamas. We never thought to take a change of clothes. I'm going to take him down to the cafeteria, get some lunch. You want something? I shake my head. Scooting my chair closer to Kate's bed, I smooth the covers over her legs. I take her hand and measure it against my own. Her eyes slid open. For a moment, she struggles, unsure of where she is. Kate, I whisper, I'm right here. As she turns her head and focuses on me, I lift her palm to my mouth, press a kiss in its center. You are so brave, I tell her, and then I smile. When I grow up, I want to be just like you. To my surprise, Kate shakes her head hard. Her voice is a feather, a thread.
No, Mommy,
she says.
You'd be sick.
In my first dream, the IV fluid is dripping too quickly into Kate's central line. The saline pumps her up from the inside out, a balloon to be inflated. I try to pull the infusion, but it's held fast in the central line. As I watch, Kate's features smooth, blur, obliterate, until her face is a white oval that could be anyone at all. In my second dream, I am in a maternity ward giving birth. My body tunnels in, my heart pulses low in my belly. There is a rush of pressure, and then the baby arrives in a lightning rush and flow. It's a girl, the nurse beams, and she hands me the newborn. I pull the pink blanket from her face, then stop. This isn't Kate, I say. Of course not, the nurse agrees, but she's still yours. The angel that arrives is wearing Armani and barking into a cell phone as she enters the hospital room. Sell it, my sister orders. I don't care if you have to set up a lemonade stand in Faneuil Hall and give the shares away, Peter. I said sell. She pushes a button and holds out her arms to me. Hey, Zan soothes when I burst into tears. Did you really think I'd listen to you when you told me not to come? But faxes, phones, I can work from your home. Who else is going to watch Jesse? Brian and I look at each other. We haven't thought that far. In response, Brian stands up, hugs Zan awkwardly. Jesse runs toward her at full tilt. Who's that kid you adopted, Sarah? Because Jesse can't possibly be that big. She disengages Jesse from her knees and leans down over the hospital bed where Kate is sleeping. I bet you don't remember me, Zan says, her eyes bright, but I remember you. It comes so easy, letting her take charge. Zan gets Jesse involved in a game of tic-tac-toe and bullies a Chinese restaurant that doesn't deliver into bringing up lunch. I sit beside Kate, basking in my sister's competence. I let myself pretend she can fix the things I can't. After Zan takes Jesse home for the night, Brian and I become bookends in the dark, bracketing Kate. Brian, I whisper, I've been thinking. He shifts in his seat. What about? I lean forward so that I catch his eye. Having a baby. Brian's eyes narrow. Jesus, Sarah. He gets to his feet, turns his back to me. Jesus. I stand up too. It's not what you think. When he faces me, pain draws every line of his features tight. We can't just replace Kate if she dies, he says. In the hospital bed, Kate shifts, rustling the sheets. I force myself to imagine her at age 4, wearing a Halloween costume, age 12, trying out lip gloss, age 20, dancing around a dorm room. I know. So we have to make sure that she doesn't.
Wednesday. From Fire Pages by Carl Sandburg. I will read ashes for you, if you ask me. I will look in the fire and tell you from the gray lashes and out of the red and black tongues and stripes. I will tell how fire comes and how fire runs as far as the sea. Campbell. We are all, I suppose, beholden to our parents. The question is, how much? This is what runs through my mind while my mother jabbers on about my father's latest affair. Not for the first time, I wish for siblings. If only so that I would receive sunrise phone calls like this only once or twice a week instead of 7. Mother, I interrupt, I doubt that she's actually 16. You underestimate your father, Campbell. Maybe, but I also know that he's a federal judge. He may leer after schoolgirls, but he'd never do anything illegal. Mom, I'm late for court. I'll check back in with you later, I say, and I hang up before she can protest. I'm not going to court, but still. Taking a deep breath, I shake my head and find Judge staring at me. Reason number 106, why dogs are smarter than humans, I say. Once you leave the litter, you sever contact with your mothers. I walk into the kitchen as I'm knotting my tie. My apartment, it is a work of art. Sleek and minimalist. But what is there is the best that money can buy. A one-of-a-kind black leather couch. A flat-screen television hanging on the wall. A locked glass case filled with signed first editions from authors like Hemingway and Hawthorne. My coffee maker comes imported from Italy. My refrigerator is sub-zero. I open it and find a single onion, a bottle of ketchup, and three rolls of black and white film. This, too, is no surprise. I rarely eat at home. Judge is so used to restaurant food, he wouldn't recognize kibble if it slid its way down his throat. What do you think? I ask him. Rosies sound good? He barks as I fasten his service dog harness. Judge and I have been together for 7 years. I bought him from a breeder of police dogs, but he was specially trained with me in mind. As for his name, well, what attorney wouldn't want to be able to put a judge in a crate every now and then? Rosie's is what Starbucks wishes it was, eclectic and funky, crammed with patrons who at any time might be reading Russian Lit in its original tongue, or balancing a company's budget on a laptop, or writing a screenplay while mainlining caffeine. Judge and I usually walk there and sit at our usual table in the back. We order a double espresso and two chocolate croissants, and we flirt shamelessly with Ophelia, the 20-year-old waitress. But today, when we walk inside, Ophelia is nowhere to be found, and there is a woman sitting at our table, feeding a toddler in a stroller a bagel. This throws me for such a loop, the judge needs to tug me to the only spot that's free, a stool at the counter that looks out on the street. 7:30 a.m., and already this day is a bust. A heroin-thin boy, with enough rings in his eyebrows to resemble a shower curtain rod, approaches with a pad. He sees Judge at my feet.
Sorry, dude, no dogs allowed.
This is a service dog, I explain. Where's Ophelia?
She's gone, man. Eloped last night.
Eloped? People still do that? With whom? I asked, though it's none of my business.
Some performance artist who sculpts dog crap into busts of world leaders. It's supposed to be a statement.
I feel a momentary pang for poor Ophelia. Take it from me, love has all the lasting permanence of a rainbow. Beautiful while it's there, and just as likely to have disappeared by the time you blink. The waiter reaches into his back pocket and hands me a plastic card.
Here's the Braille menu.
I want a double espresso and two croissants, and I'm not blind.
Then what's Fido for?
I have SARS, I say. He's tallying the people I infect. The waiter can't seem to figure out if I'm joking. He backs away, unsure, to get my coffee. Unlike my normal table, this one has a view of the street. I watch an elderly lady narrowly avoid the swipe of a taxi. A boy dances past with a radio three times the size of his head balanced on his shoulder. Twins in parochial school uniforms giggle behind the pages of a teen magazine. And a woman with a running river of black hair spills coffee on her skirt, dropping the paper cup on the pavement. Inside me, everything stops. I wait for her to lift her face to see if this could possibly be who I think it is. But she turns away from me, blotting the fabric with a napkin. A bus cuts the world in half, and my cell phone begins to ring. I glance down at the incoming number. No surprise there. Turning off the power button without bothering to take my mother's call, I glance back at the woman outside the window. But by then, the bus is gone, and so is she. I open the door of the office, already barking orders for Kerry. Call Austerlitz and ask him whether he's available to testify during the Whalen trial. Get a list of other complainants who've gone up against New England Power in the last 5 years.
Make me a copy of the Melbourne deposition. And phone Jerry at the court and ask who the judge is going to be for the Fitzgerald kid's hearing. She glances up at me as the phone begins to ring.
Speaking of...
She jerks her head in the direction of the door to my inner sanctum. Anna Fitzgerald stands on the threshold with a spray can of industrial cleaner and a chamois cloth, polishing the doorknob.
What are you doing? I ask. What you told me to.
She looks down at the dog.
Hey, Judge.
Line two for you, Carrie interrupts. I give her a measured look. Why she even let this kid in here is beyond me. And try to get into my office, but whatever Anna has put on the hardware makes it too greasy to turn. I struggle for a moment until she grips the knob with the cloth and opens the door for me. Judge circles the floor, finding the most comfortable spot. I punch the blinking light on the call row. Campbell Alexander.
Mr. Alexander, this is Sarah Fitzgerald, Anna Fitzgerald's mother.
I let this information settle. I stare at her daughter, polishing a mere 5 feet away. Mrs. Fitzgerald, I answer, and as expected, Anna stops in her tracks.
I'm calling because, well, you see, this is all a misunderstanding.
Have you filed a response to the petition?
That isn't going to be necessary. I spoke to Anna last night, and she isn't going to continue with her case. She wants to do anything she can to help Kate.
Is that so? My voice falls flat. Unfortunately, if my client is planning to call off her lawsuit, I'll need to hear it directly from her. I raise a brow, catch Anna's gaze. You wouldn't happen to know where she is.
She went out for a run, Sarah Fitzgerald says. But we're going to come down to the courthouse this afternoon. We'll talk to the judge and get this straightened out.
I suppose I'll see you then. I hang up the phone and cross my arms, look at Anna. Is there something you'd like to tell me? She shrugs.
Not really.
That's not what your mother seems to think. Then again, she's also under the impression you're out playing Flojo. Anna glances out into the reception area, where Carrie, naturally, is hanging on our words like a cat on a rope. She closes the door and walks up to my desk.
I couldn't tell her I was coming here. Not after last night.
What happened last night? When Anna goes mute, I lose my patience. Listen, if you're not going through with a lawsuit, if this is a colossal waste of my time, then I'd appreciate it if you had the honesty to tell me now rather than later. Because I'm not a family therapist or your best buddy. I'm your attorney. And for me to be your attorney, there actually has to be a case. So I will ask you one more time, have you changed your mind about this lawsuit? I expect this tirade to put an end to the litigation, to reduce Anna to a wavering puddle of indecision. But to my surprise, she looks right at me, cool and collected.
Are you still willing to represent me?
She asks. Against my better judgment, I say yes.
Then no, she says. I haven't changed my mind.
The first time I sailed in a yacht club race with my father, I was 14, and he was dead set against it. I wasn't old enough, I wasn't mature enough, the weather was too iffy. What he really was saying was that having me crew for him was more likely to lose him the cup than to win it. In my father's eyes, if you weren't perfect, you simply weren't. His boat was a USA One class, a marvel of mahogany and teak. One he'd bought from the keyboard player Jay Giles up in Marblehead. In other words, a dream, a status symbol, and a rite of passage all wrapped up in a gleaming white sail and honey-colored hull. We hit the start dead on, crossing the line at full sail just as the cannon shot off. I did my best to be a step ahead of where my father needed me to be, guiding the rudder before he even gave the order. Jibbing and tacking until my muscles burned with effort. And maybe this even would have had a happy ending, but then a storm blew in from the north, bringing sheets of rain and swells that stretched 10 feet high, pitching us from height to gully.
I watched my father move in his yellow slicker. He didn't seem to notice it was raining. He certainly didn't want to crawl into a hole and clutch his sick stomach and die like I did. "Campbell!" he bellowed. "Come about!" But to turn into the wind meant to ride another roller coaster up and down. "Campbell!" my father repeated. "Now!" A trough opened up in front of us. The boat dipped so sharply I lost my footing. My father lunged past me, grabbing for the rudder. For one blessed moment, the sails went still. Then the boom whipped across, and the boat tacked along an opposite course. "I need coordinates," my father ordered. Navigating meant going down into the hull where the charts were, and doing the math to figure out what heading we had to be on to reach the next race buoy. But being below, away from the fresh air, only made it worse. I opened a map just in time to throw up all over it. My father found me by default, because I hadn't returned with an answer. He poked his head down and found me sitting in a puddle of my own vomit. "For Christ's sake," he muttered, and left me. It took all the strength I had to pull myself up after him. He jerked the wheel and yanked at the rudder. He pretended I wasn't there. And when he jibbed, he didn't call it. The sail whizzed across the boat, ripping the seam of the sky. The boom flew, clipped me on the back of the head, and knocked me out. I came to just as my father was stealing the wind of another boat mere feet from the finish line. The rain had mellowed to a mist, and as he put our craft between the airstream and our closest competitor, the other boat fell back. We won by seconds. I was told to clean up my mess and take the taxi in while my father sailed the dory to the yacht club to celebrate. It was an hour later when I finally arrived, and by then he was in high spirits, drinking scotch from the crystal cup he had won. "Here comes your crew, Cam," a friend called out. My father lifted the victory cup in salute, drank deeply, and then slammed it down so hard on the bar that its handle shattered. "Oh," said another sailor, "that's a shame." My father never took his eyes off me. "Isn't it, though?" he said. On the rear bumper of practically every third car in Rhode Island, you'll find a red and white sticker celebrating the victims of some of the bigger criminal cases in the state. My friend Katie DeKubelis was killed by a drunk driver. My friend John Sisson was killed by a drunk driver. These are given out at school fairs and fundraisers and hair salons. And it doesn't matter if you never knew the kid who got killed. You put them on your vehicle out of solidarity and secret joy that this tragedy did not happen to you. Last year, there were red and white stickers with a new victim's name, Dina DeSalvo. Unlike the other victims, this was one I knew marginally. She was the 12-year-old daughter of a judge, who reportedly broke down during a custody trial held shortly after the funeral and took a 3-month leave of absence to deal with his grief. The same judge, incidentally, who has been assigned to Anna Fitzgerald's case. As I make my way into the Garrahy complex, where the family court is housed, I wonder if a man carrying around so much baggage will be able to try a case where a winning outcome for my client will precipitate the death of her teenage sister. There's a new bailiff at the entrance, a man with a neck as thick as a redwood and most likely the brain power to match. "Sorry," he says, "no pets." This is a service dog. Confused, the bailiff leans forward and peers into my eyes. I do the same, right back at him. "I'm nearsighted. He helps me read the road signs." Stepping around the guy, Judge and I head down the hall to the courtroom. Inside, the clerk is being taken down a peg by Anna Fitzgerald's mother. That's my assumption, at least, because in actuality, the woman looks nothing like her daughter, who stands beside her. "I'm quite sure that in this case, the judge would understand," Sarah Fitzgerald argues. Her husband waits a few feet behind her, apart. When Anna notices me, a wash of relief rushes over her features. I turn to the clerk of the court. I'm Campbell Alexander, I say. Is there a problem? I've been trying to explain to Mrs. Fitzgerald here that we only allow attorneys into chambers. Well, I'm here on behalf of Anna, I reply. The clerk turns to Sarah Fitzgerald. Who's representing your party? Anna's mother is stricken for a moment. She turns to her husband. It's like riding a bicycle, she says quietly. Her husband shakes his head. Are you sure you want to do this? I don't want to do this. I have to do this. The words fall into place like cogs. Hang on, I say. You're a lawyer? Sarah turns. Well, yes. I glance down at Anna, incredulous. And you neglected to mention this?
You never asked, she whispers.
The clerk gives each of us an entry of appearance form and summons the sheriff. Vern, Sarah smiles. Good to see you again. Oh, this just keeps getting better. Hey! The sheriff kisses her cheek, shakes hands with the husband. Brian! So not only is she an attorney, but she also has all the public servants in the palm of her hand. Are we finished with Old Home Day? I ask. And Sarah Fitzgerald rolls her eyes at the sheriff.
The guy's a jerk, but what are you going to do?
Stay here, I tell Anna. And I follow her mother back toward chambers. Judge DeSalvo was a short man with a monobrow and a fondness for coffee milk. Good morning, he says, waving us toward our seats. What's with the dog?
He's a service dog, Your Honor.
Before he can say anything else, I leap into the genial conversation that heralds every meeting in chambers in Rhode Island. We are a small state, smaller still in the legal community. It is not only conceivable that your paralegal is the niece or sister-in-law of the judge with whom you're meeting, it's downright likely. As we chat, I glance over at Sarah, who needs to understand which of us is part of this game and which of us isn't. Maybe she was an attorney, but not in the 10 years I've been one. She is nervous, pleating the bottom of her blouse. Judge DeSalvo notices, I didn't know you were practicing law again. I wasn't planning to, Your Honor, but the complainant is my daughter. At that, the judge turns to me. Well, what's this all about, Counselor? Mrs. Fitzgerald's youngest daughter is seeking medical emancipation from her parents. Sarah shakes her head. That's not true, Judge. Hearing his name, my dog glances up. I spoke to Anna, and she assured me she really doesn't want to do this. She had a bad day and wanted a little extra attention. Sarah lifts a shoulder. You know how 13-year-olds can be. The room grows so quiet I can hear my own pulse. Judge DeSalvo doesn't know how 13-year-olds can be. His daughter died when she was 12. Sarah's face flames red. Like the rest of this state, she knows about Dina DeSalvo. For all I know, she's got one of the bumper stickers on her minivan. Oh, God, I'm sorry. I didn't mean... The judge looks away. Mr. Alexander, when was the last time you spoke with your client? Yesterday morning, Your Honor. She was in my office when her mother called me to say it was a misunderstanding. Predictably, Sarah's jaw drops. She couldn't have been. She was jogging. I look at her. You sure about that? She was supposed to be jogging. Your Honor, I say, this is precisely my point, and the reason Anna Fitzgerald's petition has merit. Her own mother isn't aware of where she is on any given morning. Medical decisions regarding Anna are made with the same haphazard... Counselor Cannett. The judge turns to Sarah. Your daughter told you she wanted to call off the lawsuit?
Yes.
He glances at me. And she told you that she wanted to continue.
That's right.
Then I'd better talk directly to Anna. When the judge gets up and walks out of chambers, we follow. Anna is sitting on a bench in the hall with her father. One of her sneakers is untied.
"I spy something green," I hear her say, and then she looks up.
"Anna," I say, at the exact same moment as Sarah Fitzgerald. It is my responsibility to explain to Anna that Judge DeSalvo wants a few minutes in private. I need to coach her, so that she says the right things, so that the judge doesn't throw the case out before she gets what she wants. She is my client. By definition, she is supposed to follow my counsel. But when I call her name, she turns toward her mother.
Anna, I don't think anyone would come to my funeral. My parents, I guess, and Aunt Zan, and maybe Mr. Ollencott, the social studies teacher. I picture the same cemetery we went to for my grandmother's funeral, although that was in Chicago, so it doesn't really make any sense. There would be rolling hills that look like green velvet, and statues of gods and lesser angels, and that big brown hole in the ground like a split seam, waiting to swallow the body that used to be me. I imagine my mom in a black-veiled Jackie O hat, sobbing. My dad holding on to her. Kate and Jesse staring at the shine of the coffin and trying to plea bargain with God for all the times they did something mean to me. It is possible that some of the guys from my hockey team would come, clutching lilies and their composure. "That Anna," they'd say. And they wouldn't cry, but they'd want to. There would be an obituary on page 24 of the paper, and maybe Kyle McPhee would see it and come to the funeral, his beautiful face twisted up with the what-ifs of the girlfriend he never got to have. I think there would be flowers, sweet peas and snapdragons and blue balls of hydrangea. I hope someone would sing Amazing Grace, not just the famous first verse, but all of them. And afterward, when the leaves turned and the snow came, every now and then I would rise in everyone's mind like a tide. At Kate's funeral, everyone will come. There will be nurses from the hospital who've gotten to be our friends, and other cancer patients still counting their lucky stars, and townspeople who've helped raise money for her treatments. They will have to turn mourners away at the cemetery gates. There will be so many lush funeral baskets that some will be donated to charity. The newspaper will run a story of her short and tragic life. Mark my words, it will be on the front page. Judge DeSalvo's wearing flip-flops, the kind soccer players wear when they take off their cleats. I don't know why, but this makes me feel a little better. I mean, it's bad enough I'm here in this courthouse, being led toward his private room in the back. There's something nice about knowing that I'm not the only one who doesn't quite fit the part. He takes a can from a dwarf fridge and asks me what I'd like to drink. "Coke would be great," I say. The judge opens a can of Coke. "Did you know that if you leave a baby tooth in a glass of Coke, in a few weeks it'll completely disappear? Carbonic acid." He smiles at me. "My brother is a dentist in Warwick. Does that trick every year for the kindergartners." I take a sip of Coke and imagine my insides dissolving. Judge DeSalvo doesn't sit down behind his desk, but instead takes a chair right next to me. "Here's the problem, Anna," he says. "Your mom is telling me you want to do one thing, and your lawyer is telling me you want to do another. Now, under normal circumstances, I'd expect your mother to know you better than some guy you met 2 days ago. But you never would have met this guy if you hadn't sought him out for his services. And that makes me think that I need to hear what you think about all this." "Can I ask you something?"
"Sure," he says.
"Does there have to be a trial?"
"Well, your parents can just agree to medical emancipation, and that would be that," the judge says. "Like that would ever happen. On the other hand, once someone files a petition, like you have, then the respondent, your parents, have to go to court. If your parents really believe you're not ready to make these kinds of decisions by yourself, they have to present their reasons to me, or else risk having me find in your favor by default. I nod.
I have told myself that no matter what, I'm going to keep cool. If I fall apart at the seams, there's no way this judge will think I'm capable of deciding anything. I have all these brilliant intentions, but I get sidetracked by the sight of the judge, lifting his can of apple juice. Not too long ago, when Kate was in the hospital to get her kidneys checked out, a new nurse handed her a cup and asked for a urine sample.
"It better be ready when I come back for it," she said.
Kate, who isn't a fan of snotty demands, decided the nurse needed to be taken down a peg. She sent me out on a mission to the vending machines to get the very juice that the judge is drinking now. She poured this into the specimen cup, and when the nurse came back, held it up to the light.
"Huh," Kate said. "Looks a little cloudy. Better filter it through again." And then she lifted it to her lips and drank it down. The nurse turned white and flew out of the room. Kate and I, we laughed until our stomachs cramped. For the rest of that day, all we had to do was catch each other's eyes and we'd dissolve.
Like a tooth. And then there's nothing left.
"Anna?" Judge DeSalvo prompts.
And then he sets that stupid can of Mott's down on the table between us. And I burst into tears.
"I can't give a kidney to my sister. I just can't."
Without a word, Judge DeSalvo hands me a box of Kleenex. I wad some into a ball, wipe at my eyes and my nose. For a while, he's quiet, letting me catch my breath. When I look up, I find him waiting.
"Anna, no hospital in this country will take an organ from an unwilling donor."
"Who do you think signs off on it?" I ask. "Not the little kid getting wheeled into the OR. Her parents."
"You're not a little kid. You could certainly make your objections known," he says.
"Oh, right," I say, tearing up again. "When you complain because someone's sticking a needle into you for the 10th time, it's considered standard operating procedure. All the adults look around with fake smiles and tell each other that no one voluntarily asks for more needles."
I blow my nose into a Kleenex.
"The kidney, that's just today. Tomorrow it'll be something else. It's always something else."
"Your mother told me you want to drop the lawsuit," he says. "Did she lie to me?"
"No."
I swallow hard.
"Then why did you lie to her?"
There are 1,000 answers for that. I choose the easy one.
"Because I love her," I say. And the tears come all over again. "I'm sorry. I'm really sorry."
He stares at me hard.
"You know what, Anna? I'm going to appoint someone who's going to help your lawyer tell me what's best for you. How does that sound?"
My hair's fallen all over the place. I tuck it behind my ear. My face is so red it feels swollen.
"Okay," I answer.
"Okay."
He presses an intercom button and asks to have everyone else sent back. My mother comes into the room first, and starts to make her way over to me until Campbell and his dog cut her off. He raises his brows and gives me a thumbs-up sign, but it's a question.
"I'm not sure what's going on," Judge DeSalvo says. "So I'm appointing a guardian ad litem to spend 2 weeks with her. Needless to say, I expect full cooperation on both your parts. I want the guardian ad litem's report back, and then we'll have a hearing. If there's anything more I need to know at that time, bring it with you."
2 weeks, my mother says. I know what she's thinking. "Your Honor, with all due respect, 2 weeks is a very long time given the severity of my daughter's illness." She looks like someone I do not recognize. I have seen her before be a tiger, fighting a medical system that isn't moving fast enough for her. I have seen her be a rock, giving the rest of us something to cling to. I have seen her be a boxer, coming up swinging before the next punch can be thrown by fate. but I have never seen her be a lawyer before. Judge DeSalvo nods.
All right. We'll have a hearing next Monday, then. In the meantime, I want Kate's medical records brought to...
Your Honor, Campbell Alexander interrupts. As you're well aware, due to the strange circumstances of this case, my client is living with opposing counsel. That's a flagrant breach of justice. My mother sucks in her breath. You are not suggesting my child be taken away from me.
Taken away? Where would I go? I can't be sure that opposing counsel won't try to use her living arrangements to her best advantage, Your Honor, and possibly pressure my client.
Campbell stares right at the judge, unblinking.
Mr. Alexander, there is no way I am pulling this child out of her home, Judge DeSalvo says, but then he turns to my mother. However, Mrs. Fitzgerald, you cannot talk about this case with your daughter unless her attorney is present. If you can't agree to that, or if I hear of any breach in that domestic Chinese wall, I may have to take more drastic action.
Understood, Your Honor, my mother says.
Well, Judge DeSalvo stands up. I'll see you all next week.
He walks out of the room, his flip-flops making small, sucking slaps on the tile floor. The minute he is gone, I turn to my mother. I can explain, I want to say, but it never makes its way out loud. Suddenly a wet nose pokes into my hand. Judge. It makes my heart, that runaway train, slow down.
I need to speak to my client, Campbell says.
Right now, she's my daughter, my mother says, and then she takes my hand and yanks me out of my chair. At the threshold of the door, I manage to look back. Campbell's fuming. I could have told him it would wind up like this. Daughter trumps everything, no matter what the game. World War III begins immediately. Not with an assassinated archduke or a crazy dictator, but with a missed left turn. Brian, my mother says, craning her neck, that was North Park Street. My father blinks out of his fog. You could have told me before I passed it. I did! Before I can even weigh the costs and benefits of entering someone else's battle again, I say, I didn't hear you. My mother's head whips around. Anna, right now, you are the last person whose input I need or want. I just... She holds up her hand like the privacy partition in a cab. She shakes her head. On the back seat, I slide sideways and curl my feet up, facing to the rear so all that I can see is black. Brian, my mother says, you missed it again. When we walk in, my mother steams past Kate, who opened the door for us, and past Jesse, who is watching what looks like the scrambled Playboy channel on TV. In the kitchen, she opens cabinets and bangs them shut. She takes food from the refrigerator and smacks it onto the table. Hey, my father says to Kate. How are you feeling? She ignores him, pushing into the kitchen. What happened? What happened? Well, my mother pins me with a gaze. Why did you ask your sister what happened? Kate turns to me, all eyes. Amazing how quiet you are now, when a judge isn't listening, my mother says. Jesse turns off the television. She made you talk to a judge? Damn, Anna. My mother closes her eyes. Jesse, you know, now would be a good time for you to leave.
You don't have to ask me twice, he says, his voice full of broken glass.
We hear the front door open and shut. A whole story.
Sarah, my father steps into the room. We all need to cool off a little.
I have one child who's just signed her sister's death sentence, and I'm supposed to cool off? The kitchen gets so silent, we can hear the refrigerator whispering. My mother's words hang like too ripe fruit, and when they fall on the floor and burst, she shudders into motion. Kate, she says, hurrying towards my sister, her arms already outstretched. Kate, I shouldn't have said that. It's not what I meant. In my family, we seem to have a tortured history of not saying what we ought to and not meaning what we do. Kate covers her mouth with her hand. She backs out the kitchen door, bumping into my father, who fumbles but cannot catch her as she scrambles upstairs. I hear the door to our room slam shut. My mother, of course, goes after her. So I do what I do best. I move in the opposite direction. Is there any place on earth that smells better than a laundromat? It's like a rainy Sunday when you don't have to get out from under your covers. Or like lying back on the grass your father's just mowed. Comfort food for your nose. When I was little, my mom would take hot clothes out of the dryer and dump them on top of me where I was sitting on the couch. I used to pretend they were a single skin, that I was curled tight beneath them like one large heart. The other thing I like is that laundromats draw lonely people like metal to magnets. There's a guy passed out on a bank of chairs in the back, with army boots and a t-shirt that says Nostradamus was an optimist. A woman at a folding table sifts through a heap of men's button-down shirts, sniffing back tears. Put 10 people together in a laundromat.